Hi, this is Jason Smith, letting you know that this is the last episode of this third season of Digital Jung. I'll be taking a break for the summer, but I'll be back with new episodes and a new season in the fall. I'd like to also take a moment to express my gratitude to the many people who have offered appreciation, encouragement, and support for this podcast throughout the year. It really means a great deal to me. So thank you. And as always, thanks for listening, and take good care. Welcome to Digital Jung, a podcast about living a symbolic life in a technological age.
Man cannot stand a meaningless life.
I'm Jason Smith, Jungian analyst and your host for this show. And in this episode, I conclude this series on the fairy tale, The Iron Stove, with a discussion of just what constitutes the goal of the symbolic life.
It's the human soul. That's the buried treasure.
To enter a realm of immediate experience is most stimulating for those who have done their utmost in the personal and rational spheres of life and yet have found no meaning and no satisfaction there. In this way, too, the matter of fact and the commonplace come to wear an altered countenance and can even acquire a new glamour, for it all depends on how we look at things, and not how things are in themselves. The least of things with a meaning is worth more in life than the greatest of things without it. So we have arrived at the fourth and final episode of this series, taking a deep dive look at the fairy tale, The Iron Stove. And I said at the outset of this series that staying with one story all the way through would allow for greater attention to some of the details and subtleties contained in the story. And while that's certainly the case, it's also true that there is so much more that could be discovered and explored in this tale than I have been able to do in just 4 half-hour podcast episodes. I could easily have expanded this series to 8 or even 12 or more episodes and still not exhausted all the possibilities within it. We're dealing, after all, with symbolic material, that is, an expression in the form of image and story of something beyond expression, of some depth or breadth of human experience that cannot ultimately be formulated conceptually. A symbolic image is resonant with this something. It's full of overtones and echoes, hints and intuitions, and multiple levels of meaning that sound through it like a chorus of voices. And my hope in doing a series like this, and indeed the whole podcast itself, is that it will enable us to attune our ears to some of these voices and thereby begin to learn the art of what I call deep listening. And so, with that said, I'd like to jump right back into the last two sections of our story. When we left the king's daughter, she had just spent the night in the house full of toads. The toads had welcomed her, fed her, and given her a safe place to sleep. At this point, as she is preparing to head out to continue her search for the king's son, the big toad gives her some things that she'll need on her journey. And the story continues. Then she gave her three things, which she was to take the greatest care of, namely, three large needles, a plow wheel, and three nuts. With these, she traveled onwards, and when she came to the glass mountain, which was so slippery, she stuck the three needles first behind her feet, and then before them, and so got over it. And when she was over it, she hid them in a place which she marked carefully. After this, she came to the three piercing swords, and then she seated herself on her plow wheel and rolled over them. At last, she arrived in front of a great lake, and when she had crossed it, she came to a large and beautiful castle. She went and asked for a place. She was a poor girl, she said, and would like to be hired. She knew, however, that the king's son, whom she had released from the iron stove in the great forest, was in the castle. Then she was taken as a scullery maid at low wages. But already the king's son had another maiden by his side whom he wanted to marry, for he thought that she had long been dead. From the Jungian point of view, a fairy tale tells the truth, which is not to say that we believe that there is really a land somewhere out there with glass mountains and fields of swords sticking up out of the ground. It's a true story about a different order of experience, which Jung calls psychological reality, and which we could think of as archetypal reality. And this order of reality cannot, finally, be described in rational and concrete terms without a loss of that resonant something that I mentioned earlier. It's communicated by way of symbols and images. And speaking from the religious perspective, the author and scholar Diana Eck expresses the issue perfectly. She writes, "The investigation of the spirit does not lend itself to philosophy as much as to poetry. It is elusive of our mind's grasp, vital, powerful, and yet insubstantial." And so I want to imagine the journey of the king's daughter as a journey within. The distance traveled is not measured in terms of space, but of depth, which itself is a kind of poetic metaphor, I would say, for the alteration of consciousness that takes place in any inner or creative work. The image of the journey tells us that it takes some time to come to the other shore where symbols and images speak to us. Time and what I would call non-effortful effort. When we first encounter a symbol, it's like a glass mountain that rises up before us. It's impenetrable. It seems to say nothing at all except, perhaps, turn back. It lacks any real feeling quality for us and tends to leave us cold. It's slippery, and we can find no purchase with it. The Jungian analyst Robert Bosnack describes this experience as it manifests in working with one's dreams. It's an aspect of inner work, he suggests, that cannot be avoided and can never be mastered. And this is because it is of the essence of the symbolic world itself. As he writes, the dream is not at home in our daytime consciousness. Every dream requires a switchover into a dreamlike consciousness that can follow the dream world. This switchover into dream consciousness is a shock. Daytime consciousness stumbles when confronted with a kind of logic that is essentially alien to it. And the way over this barrier is patience. It's necessary to slow down and take a kind of steady, step-by-step approach. The story tells us that the king's daughter, facing the glass mountain, took the three needles given to her by the toads and put them first behind her feet and then before them, and so got over it. Step by step, right? This is the same wisdom as that found in the Tao Te Ching. A journey of 1,000 miles starts under one's feet. Now, needles, of course, suggest sewing, which in turn suggests both paying close attention to that which is tiny and subtle, as well as entering into a kind of reverie. Activities like knitting and sewing by hand are often accompanied by the free play of memory and imagination. As the hands move, the mind wanders. Through reverie, we can catch unexpected threads of understanding. Such close attention and care opens the way to insights that truly move mountains. Now contrast the tiny needles in this section of the story with the next barrier, the large, piercing swords. Swords, traditionally, are images of thought. A sword cuts things in two. They stand then for that power of discrimination that helps us to separate one thing from another, and therefore to see each thing individually. This is the way of analysis, which cuts things up into parts. And this is useful and helpful in certain situations, but it also has the consequence of separating the part from its living context in the whole. The whole, as we know, is not just the sum of its parts, which means, of course, that knowing the parts of something will never be sufficient to bring us to wholeness. And this is why Jung makes the startling statement in one of his interviews that analysis kills and synthesis brings to life. The sword of thought, analysis, must give way to synthesis. And there's a lot that could be said about just what this means, but one facet of it is what Samuel Taylor Coleridge calls the suspension of disbelief. That is, a setting aside of one's rational and critical judgment, both of the symbolic material and of one's own participation in it, in favor of a more direct, emotionally embodied, and imaginative response. The plowing down of the swords of analytic thought is the opening up to non-rational experience, which doesn't mean crazy or emotionally out of control experience, but rather experience as it is immediately given, as it presents itself to us in the living moment, and not colored or influenced by our categories or concepts or expectations. And with the achievement of this attitude of openness to the givenness of things, so says our story, we come to the Great Lake. And the interesting thing with the way that this image is presented in the tale is that there's nothing that needs to be done here. There is no problem here. The lake is not a barrier like the other trials along the way. There's no discussion of a boat needed to cross the lake, though presumably that's there somewhere. The king's daughter simply crosses it and comes to the beautiful castle. The achievement of the new way of seeing means that the arrival at the lake, the crossing of it, and the discovery of the castle are all of a piece, as if they were all different aspects of the same thing. And now her final adventure begins. The king's daughter takes a lowly position as a servant in the castle. She has achieved a necessary humility, and this will be the decisive factor in the conclusion of the tale, which I'll turn to right now. In the evening, when she had washed up and was done, she felt in her pocket and found the 3 nuts which the old toad had given her. She cracked one with her teeth and was going to eat the kernel, when lo and behold, there was a stately royal garment in it. And when the bride heard of this, she came and asked for the dress and wanted to buy it, and said, "It is not a dress for a servant girl." "No," she said, "she would not sell it. But if the bride would grant her one thing, she should have it." And that was permission to sleep one night in her bridegroom's chamber. The bride gave her permission because the dress was so pretty and she had never had one like it. When it was evening, she said to her bridegroom, "That silly girl will sleep in your room." "If you are willing, so am I," said he. She, however, gave him a glass of wine in which she had poured a sleeping draught. So the bridegroom and the scullery maid went to sleep in the room, and he slept so soundly that she could not waken him. She wept the whole night and cried, "I set you free when you were in an iron stove in the wild forest. I sought you and walked over a glass mountain and 3 sharp swords and a great lake before I found you, and yet you will not hear me." The servants sat by the chamber door and heard how she thus wept the whole night through. And in the morning, they told it to their lord. And the next evening, when she had washed up, she opened the 2nd nut, and a far more beautiful dress was within it. And when the bride beheld it, she wished to buy that also. But the girl would not take money, and begged that she might once again sleep in the bridegroom's chamber. The bride, however, gave him a sleeping draught, and he slept so soundly that he could hear nothing. But the scullery maid wept the whole night long and cried, I set you free when you were in an iron stove in the wild forest. I sought you and walked over a glass mountain and over three sharp swords and a great lake before I found you, and yet you will not hear me." The servants sat by the chamber door and heard her weeping the whole night through, and in the morning informed their lord of it. And on the third evening, when she had washed up, she opened the third nut, and within it was a still more beautiful dress, which was stiff with pure gold. When the bride saw that, she wanted to have it. But the maiden only gave it up on condition that she might, for the third time, sleep in the bridegroom's apartment. The king's son, however, was on his guard and threw the sleeping draught away. Now when she began to weep and to cry, "Dearest love, I set you free when you were in the iron stove in the terrible wild forest," the king's son leapt up and said, "You are the true one. You are mine, and I am yours." Thereupon, while it was still night, he got into a carriage with her, and they took away the false bride's clothes so that she could not get up. When they came to the great lake, they sailed across it, and when they reached the three sharp cutting swords, they seated themselves on the plow wheel, and when they got to the glass mountain, they thrust the three needles in it, and so at length they got to the little old house. But when they went inside, it was a great castle, and the toads were all disenchanted and were king's children and full of happiness. Then the wedding was celebrated, and the king's son and the princess remained in the castle, which was much larger than the castle of their fathers. But as the old king grieved at being left alone, they fetched him away and brought him to live with them. And then they had two kingdoms and lived in happy wedlock. I spoke about humility a few moments ago. And just before we begin looking at this last section of our story, I think it's important to be clear about what humility is and what it's not. There's a certain kind of self-diminishment that often gets confused with humility. A refusal to accept praise, a total relinquishing of all personal needs or interests, a knee-jerk deference to the desires and judgments of others, or even a kind of martyr complex. And all of these, Jung would say, are simply the other side of pride, the mask behind which self-importance often lies hidden. And this is because what we are thinking of in these kinds of responses and reactions is ourselves. They are full of self-consciousness or self-awareness, and humility, properly understood, is self-forgetfulness. But here's the difficulty. Self-forgetfulness isn't something that can be achieved. Which is to say, you can't try to forget yourself because in doing so, you are still thinking about yourself. Self-forgetfulness, and therefore humility, is a byproduct, so to speak, of our paying attention to the world, of becoming absorbed in something outside of ourselves. And so the experience of humility is not to be measured by some quality of obvious self-negation, but is more likely to be found in someone expressing delight, wonder, awe, compassion, love. The king's daughter is driven on by her love and is willing to take a position as a servant for this cause. She is in service to her love, by which I mean the love that inspires her, that moves her, and she's willing to do what is needed to realize it. This is the heart of everything that follows in the story. There's this scene, right, that's repeated three times in the story. The king's daughter, as the scullery maid, works all day for 3 days in a row, and each evening she discovers a beautiful dress inside one of the nuts given to her by the toads, each one more beautiful than the last. These dresses are coveted by the new bride, who is to be married to the king's son. And our hero gives the dresses away to the new bride in exchange for the opportunity to sleep in the bridegroom's chamber. The way I imagine this sequence is as a series of tests. The other bride, I would say, is not to be understood so much as a separate person, right? But as an aspect of the king's daughter herself. She is, so to speak, the part of the king's daughter that is still identified with being a princess, the one still tempted by pretty dresses, luxurious living, and her old familiar way of being. She is that aspect of the king's daughter that caused her to seek to return to her father's kingdom right after freeing the prince from the iron stove and falling in love with him. And it's as if right before the new life can finally be won, she must refuse the temptation of the old life over and over. And that's really how it is, isn't it? The old patterns, the old habits often seem to come roaring back with a vengeance just when we thought we'd finally put them to rest. Just at the moment when we find ourselves on the threshold of some new, enlivening possibility in our lives. To quote the Tao Te Ching again, people usually fail when they are on the verge of success. So give as much care to the end as to the beginning. Then there will be no failure. That doesn't mean that as we get near the end, it won't look like failure or feel like failure. This is the moment when it is so easy to give up. As the king's daughter sits in the bedchamber of her lover, he is held fast asleep by the sleeping draught of the new bride. All she can do is sit in a kind of vigil and sing her lament. But she remains loyal even through her sadness and the possibility of her failure. And this is the key. It's the new bride, or rather the old princessness of the king's daughter, that tries to keep the young prince, emblem of the new life, asleep. And it is the servants listening to her crying from behind the door that aid in bringing him awake. It is the spirit of service and not the energy of comfort or possessiveness that wins the day. And this spirit is activated by her loyalty, her steadfastness, her humility, her commitment, and ultimately, her love. And finally, for our takeaway here, I want to say a quick word about the end of the story. The release of the toads from their enchantment. In the opening quote of this episode, we heard Jung talk about the value of entering a realm of what he calls immediate experience. I alluded to something like this earlier when I talked about the image of rolling over the swords of analysis and opening up to the living moment. Jung's immediate experience, I believe, is his version of that which the religious traditions call purity of heart or beginner's mind. And it's related to what I said before about self-forgetfulness. And all of this means something like the experience of having a direct relationship with life and the world, which for Jung includes the world within, the natural movement of the psyche, as found in our dreams and in the play of the creative imagination. It means receiving life inside and out as it is given, as it presents itself to us, not as we think it should be or try to make it be. In this way, says Jung, the matter of fact and the commonplace come to wear an altered countenance and can even acquire a new glamour. This is ultimately the goal of the symbolic life. For to come into a direct relationship with life, to feel that we are in harmony with the life that is within us and outside of us, that we are participants in something larger than ourselves, that there is a love that we can serve, even if that service means that we will be tested and challenged, changes the meaning of our experiences. Or perhaps it's better to say that it reveals the meaning of our experiences, the meaning that was always there. The kingdom of the Father is spread out upon the earth, and people do not see it, says Jesus in the extra-canonical text known as the Gospel of Thomas. Then it is that those things which have seemed to be toad-like, common or ugly or even repulsive, take on a new appearance, a new and royal glow. For it all depends on how we look at things, teaches Jung, and not on how things are in themselves. The least of things with a meaning is worth more in life than the greatest of things without it. I'll be back in just a minute with this week's parting words. You'll find a list of all the sources used in this week's episode in the show notes. You'll also find links to connect with me on social media, as well as for my book, Religious But Not Religious, Living a Symbolic Life, available from Chiron Publications. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider supporting the production of this show. You can do so for as little as the cost of a cup of coffee at Buy Me a Coffee. You'll even find some extras for this show posted there from time to time. Just hit the Support the Show link in the show notes. Thank you very much. Now here are this week's parting words. There is a convention that appears in some fairy tales, a little saying or verse that is not so much part of the narrative, but is used as a kind of tag to end the tale. It's like a little ritual saying that tells the listener it's time to leave the world of the story. The Iron Stove is one of those tales that includes this little tag ending. And so it seems appropriate, as we come to the conclusion of this series, to let that be our ending. And so, a mouse did run. This story is done. Until next time.